You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening at Art Radio WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. The website is www.wps1.org. My guests today are Serge Onan, an artist and editor of drawing publications, as he put it, and Joan Cribas, a critic and curator at the Drawing Center here in New York. Hi, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi.
If you're listening along, today we're going to talk mostly about Serge's book, Drawings on Writing, and you can check that out on the web at www.drawingsonwriting.org. And if you'd like to know more about the Drawing Center as we're going along, it's drawingcenter.org as well. Maybe you guys can just start out with talking about who you are and what it is that you do, Serge?
Yes. Well, I'm an artist, and I started making publications about drawings like in 2002. This is the third book we're going to talk about, but I'm going to say something how it all started. I realized there was not such a thing as a magazine that is really on drawing in a way that it's very wide range about what drawing stands for. Not comics, not art, not but really the whole package of a definition of what drawing is. So then I started with this very ambitious idea to make a magazine, but that was too much. So then it became like these publications that have been coming out every 2 years now. And the idea was to, in a way, to define certain ideas about drawing. And with this latest issue, the third issue, the definition was, when does writing, if writing becomes illegible, for example, if you think about graffiti or about calligraphy, when does it become drawing? So I thought that was an interesting idea, because we have with our brain a very different perspective of looking at text, as handwritten text, as we do as looking at drawing. For example, of course, when you look at the text, you know there's a direction, if you don't know the language, for example, if you look at Sanskrit or like Japanese or Chinese, you don't even know if you have to go from left to right,
right,
from up to down, bottom, etc. So this whole confusion is very interesting, because when you look at an art piece, you don't have that idea. You just, you know, there's no beginning and end in looking at a drawing.
Right. So for those listening, just to give kind of an audio picture of what this book looks like, it is a fold-out book with kind of a pen drawing on the front that is scrawled and says Drawing on Writing. And you open it up, and it's loose leaves held together by the kind of an elastic rubber band inside with a nice brad on it, by the way, nice touch. And then it is, you know, pages and pages of drawings that are made through various forms of kind of writing manipulation, I would say. Now, Joan, you've seen this book.
Mm.
You know, this is, you're not coming in blind or anything, but what do you think of this book?
I think what I found really fascinating about what Serge was working on, and we spoke about the book before it came out, and I sort of saw it in development, was that there is such a rich and interesting relationship between what we tend to think of as signs, written signs, or let's say in terms of semiotics, what's called semiotics, alphabets and signs and things that signify, and the idea of the mark, which is a kind of abstracted gesture on a piece of paper. And if you think of the classic example of the sort of the cliche of the doctor's handwriting, that, you know, doctors supposedly notoriously have very bad handwriting. So a prescription is something only a pharmacist can read. And so there's an odd relationship between the total intranslatability of the handwriting and the sort of archaic knowledge and mystery of medicine. And so and that from the very basic idea, which I know since I was always mystified as a child by the doctor's prescription and the pharmacist's ability to read it, to the philosophical implications, which is at what point does a sign actually become a mark, and the relationship of written alphabets to that, And there's a really kind of interesting history that I think the book is moving around, both in terms of people like, say, Robert Walser, who's a writer who actually wrote his texts in these very small microscripts, which do not look like texts, but they're actually texts for entire novels that take up the space of a napkin. Or the very old idea of what is called memography, which is the idea that somehow letters, the shapes of letters and the sounds of words are actually representations of the things that they are representing. So, for example, the sound of the letter O, you have to make a shape to make the sound which is similar to the way the letter looks on paper.
Right.
Or for that matter, and this even extends to typography, because there's a 16th century typographer who wrote a treatise about what letters look like and their relationship to these sort of mysterious qualities, like a Y is a forked road. It's also Christ on the cross. And I think that Serge's book really brings out the place where the meaning of something is actually embedded in a weird way in its linearity, in its form, and the place where a letter starts to become an image, which I think is an interesting place.
But what's also to point out about your remark about Walser, one thing that I discovered when I was making this book is that is the history of shorthand, and the Walser texts are actually, they only discovered after his death, because when he was writing these Miko scripts, he was kind of mentally not totally there. So only after his death they discovered that it was in some very old German shorthand that was already out of fashion. But also the shorthand is interesting if you look at, for example, all the Greek, Plato, Socrates, it's all written in shorthand. Also when you read it, it's not literature that you read, but it's really recordings of spoken word.
Right, which so there are actual samples of in the book.
Yes, well, not of shorthand, not of the Greekish, not of the Greek shorthands. But there's a really long history of shorthand. And actually, before writing, there was shorthand. And now it's interesting to see that shorthand is a dying language, because, you know, it's not of any use anymore. So it's older than the alphabet.
Yeah.
But it's been, you know, hundreds of different...
I dated a stenographer once, and this was years and years ago.
Yeah.
And you know, we'd be laying in bed and talking, you know, in kind of the wee hours of the morning, and I would be like, well, what exactly do you do, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's this mystery machine up there that, you know, that has less keys than a keyboard.
Yeah.
And she would say, you know, the average person, you know, who's a good typist... And this is, you know, we're getting into typing, which is, you know, totally different, but we'll get there in just a second. Can type, you know, maybe 60 to 70 words a minute. You know, my mother, I think, can type maybe 80 or 90. She's quick, you know. I take pride in that.
Yeah.
But a stenographer can type, like, upwards of 200 to, like, 300 words a minute, which is an insane rabble. Like, it's, you know, the speed freak gone mad on the dictionary, you know, spewing from their mouth.
Yeah.
And it would baffle my mind that this weird... And she would show me strips of what it was. And it was just this kind of gobbledygook printout on like a you know, cash register receipt. But it would be every nuance of speech. And this weird kind of sign and, you know, signifier mash of little tiny lines, you know, disseminating what actually...
But in no way, I mean, but I think that what's interesting about the book is it points out that that is in no way different than the relationship we have to alphabetic signs.
Exactly.
Yeah. That it's really a question of, you know, that if we think about it through an easy way to kind of see, I think, one of the interesting distinctions in the book, or the way that the book is dealing with language as material, or the material aspect of the written word, if you will. And it's also not words. I mean, there's other things here which we may want to talk about, which are notational systems. Is the relationship of specific symbols or marks and the way that they both denote and connote things for us? For example, if you think about, you know, everything from this weird, the way that children kind of represent things, this very basic... drawings that the children tend to make. They're not purely images, that they are records in a sense of relationships, of meaning, that, and a child can look at a drawing and say, well, that's Uncle Bill, and that's the dog, and so on. And the ability to abstract from that to a language system is no different than being able to, you know, read, let's say, the stenographer marks. It's being within a system of language.
Exactly.
And I think Serge is right. The drawing is often not seen as part of that kind of graphic or grammatological system, that it's seen as an image.
Okay. Right.
But there's an interesting space, if you think about, which is, I don't think is in the book, but the heap of Smithson's heap of language, you know, where it's where language actually, it's a drawing of words, and language actually becomes a sculptural form.
Right. Yeah.
So it's interesting that the book also points towards these different ways of speaking, of noting,
right,
in an interesting way.
So to get to the artists who are actually in the book, you have an incredible array. I was much impressed. I'll tell you frankly, I was impressed. You know, from the Shakers to FBI documents to Flaubert to Napoleon to contemporary artists like Tricia Brown and even Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
You know, that the sampling is for...
But that doesn't make sense because Sherlock Holmes is not a real person.
Right, but I'm going to... Arthur Conan Doyle. Fair enough. But, you know, to me, he'll always be Holmes. as far as curatorially, is very impressive. Tell us, you know, how you came across such a wide variety of writing.
Yeah, well, that's the most fun of making these books, is that you start with certain ideas... And you have, like, you know, the obvious things. And then it's also, you know, some things I don't even put in. For example, I had, like, ideas of Henri Michaux, for example, who's, like, the most famous poet who made illegible poems. And then I discovered there's all these other French people. One of them is Roland Barthes, who also made these kind of...
crinkly looking.
Yes, and then I thought, well, you know, I'm gonna not include Henri Michaux, but I'm gonna do Roland Barthes and some other obscure lettriste artists. And then, you know, you talk to people, and for example, this is how you discover things. For example, at one certain moment, I was thinking about dance notation, and I was talking to a dancer, and I asked her, like, well, how, you know, do you know something about the history? How did they do this? You know, how did they? What's the history about it? And then you start researching it and you find amazing images. One of my favorite images in the book is this 17th century Baroque dance notation from England. And they look totally like out of this world. It's very musical, it's very, but very modern. It's difficult to describe, but... If you don't know that it's a dance score, you have no idea what you're looking at.
Right. Now, one of the ones that that I was most impressed with is that you included Earl Brown. And
yes.
Earl Brown is a personal hero of mine from many years ago for his insane notation,
yes,
as well as his music.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about what you think about kind of that correspondence between, you know, not only drawing, writing in the visual world, but then also when that jumps into kind of a musical realm, that, like,
yes,
you're in a third.
There's a lot of music. I mean, there's there's Earl Brown, and then there's this English, I always forget his name, Cornelius Cardew. He's like a hero of mine, and they're both wrote scores. They're both like contemporaries. Where they kind of left to the musician to do whatever they want with it. So they, you know, they're very skilled composers. And then, I mean, with the Cornelius Cardew pieces, I've played them myself with my band. And, you know, we just decide, we try a few things out, and let ourselves be inspired by the score, and we play it. And with the Earl Brown, when I saw it, it looked really like a drawing from Bert van der Lek, or so I was like, oh, that's really nice, because it's like, because then you think like, well, you know, you could also use anything as a score, of course.
It's almost got like a kind of an Ellsworth Kelly meets like Mondrian feel to it, you know what I mean? Like,
Well, there's an issue that happens in music. I shouldn't say an issue, there's a problem that arises in music in the post-war era, which is relevant, I think, to, not even post-war, really modernism that's relevant to the book, which is the breakdown after Schoenberg of the tonal system of music making, and composers' interest to generalize in alternative notation as a way to deal with alternative sonorities, tonalities. And so, but how do you represent that? If you're no longer using traditional harmonic, chromatic, tonal relationships, you're not making music with the old notes, if you will. Then you have to find a way to visualize that.
Right.
And what it led to with most composers was coming up with a graphic notational system, coming up with your own description, visual description for notes. What would, if you're getting rid of notes, what do you replace them with? So you end up with these kind of graphic demonstrations of sound, which in a way are a kind of writing, in the way that musical notation is a form of writing.
Like sonic onomatopoeias and things like that.
That's part of it, which also goes back to this whole idea of mimography, which also comes from Plato.
Yeah.
This idea that there's some acoustic conceptual relationship between the sound or the way a word is written and the thing that it's describing.
Right.
Which is kind of an odd idea, and I think it's permeated in the book, that somehow language has a representational direct relationship to the physical world, which is a discredited idea in linguistics. It's no longer seen as valuable, but I think it's still kind of a wonderful, playful idea when you look at handwriting or writing systems.
Right.
And then the concrete poetry, I think, is a great example of that. This sort of typewriter.
Yes.
This sort of a heart-shaped... Is it heart-shaped? I think it's like a heart-shaped.
That's the Henri Chopin.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And Chopin did all these fantastic typewriter drawings.
Yeah.
Again, using the machine for a totally different graphic purpose.
Yes.
And there's a portrait of FDR in there as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I found that one on the internet. that was another... mind, you know, where you find something and you think, oh wow, that's interesting. ASCII art, because the ASCII art is the first, when you know, the first computers with the green color started to making images, and then you get into that, and then you discover that
Chopin was doing it.
Yeah, and then even before, because I found images from the 20s. Yeah. You know, you see. It was like a hobby for people who had a typewriter. Yeah. What else can you do with the typewriter?
Well, that's
so. And then they started to draw. And there's even this one, I forgot his name. I discovered this one guy who has a website. It's somebody who lives somewhere in Pennsylvania. It's a disabled person. And who's made only the most amazing typewriter art. And I will try to look it up and link it and put a link on my website. But it's really, really remarkable. It's like this, you know, it's all like these very tiny, perfect images, and you cannot hardly see that it's been made with a typewriter. So that's like the typical folk art aspect of using the machine to do something else than it's
intended.
Yeah.
But also, it's funny you're talking about the typewriter and drawing, and I was thinking it's really interesting to think about, because with Flaubert, for example, it's interesting to think about people who used to write, who wrote by hand versus people who wrote with a machine. And I always think I always try to point out to people that Nietzsche used a typewriter, which I think is kind of interesting to think about where that positions you in history.
Yeah.
What came out of him, Now, for the reader who hasn't had a chance to look at the book, the Flaubert page is pretty damn amazing.
Yeah.
It is a handwritten page, but in fact it has been so overwritten and so like cross-referenced and arrowed and scratched out again that it looks as if it is, you know, similar to another piece, a canceled out CIA report.
Yeah, they're on the same
page.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a subject that probably most famously recently has been tackled by Janie Holzer, is the CIA reports that become so abstract.
Yes.
That in fact there's
they look like Richard Serra drawings.
Yeah, yeah. There's nothing left to them.
Yeah.
You know, tell us a little bit about that. What's your fascination with the kind of the deleted image, the crossed out, the canceled?
Well, that's actually it's quite simple, I would say, because when you erase an image, when you erase a text, you make an image. So,
like Rauschenberg's,
yeah, exactly,
the Kooning drawing,
yeah. So, yeah, it makes a different image, and there's this one image. It's like the first drawing. It's like from this. This is from a very small book by French artist Roland Topor, and he made a very nice little book. It's called Souvenir, and everything is crossed out. So it's a So it's totally, but it's really great because you know, and then the title I like very much because it, and that would also refer to all the things that have been crossed out. You know, you make a souvenir out of it, so it becomes something else. With the Flaubert, I mean, on the website that goes with the book, you see the five different versions, still the final cleaned up. Page, but the first page is really extraordinary.
Yeah. From what book is it from?
It's from a short novel. It's not from a very known. Yeah.
So unfortunately,
yeah.
That is about all the time we have
okay.
for the interview. But
yes.
I wanted to let people know where they can purchase this book because they should definitely have it in their library.
Yeah, well, the easiest would be, of course, on the internet, through the DAP, or through the website.
Which is links. drawingonwriting.org.
Yeah, JNL Books.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And what do you have coming up, Serge? What's next?
Well, a lot of different projects. Well, I can tell something about the next issue I'm going to make. That's going to be Drawings of Hands. The working title is A Manual for Hands. And again, I will be looking for, you know, it has to be something that has where I can dig into many, many different ranges of things. So for the manual, you know, when you buy a product and there's a manual with it and of course, there's all these symbolic meanings of the hand, and a lot of artists who draw hands, including myself. So we're starting to research drawing some hands.
Sounds good. When will that be?
I hope 2010.
Okay.
I think. Yeah.
All right. Sounds good. Keep us abreast.
I will.
And then, João, what do you have coming up at the Drawing Center?
Well, right now we have a retrospective of an artist named Matt Mullican, who it's about 30 years of work plus, and not irrelevant actually to what we've been talking about.
Not irrelevant.
Yeah. That's my sort of European understatement. I'm doing the first U.S. museum retrospective of a woman named Unika Zorn. Who is not very well known, a kind of late surrealist, and the partner of Hans Bellmare. And she was actually a fiction writer, and did these sort of chimeric, almost hallucinogenic drawings that we're going to be really showing for the first time. So, a writer who draws, also not irrelevant to this conversation.
Exciting stuff, and you can see more of that at the Drawing Center, or just Drawing Center.
Just drawingcenter.org.
You got it. Thank you so much, both of you gentlemen. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. You're either listening at frankprattle.com, or you're listening at the Gorgeous Fellows of WPS1.org. That is Art Radio, WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. My special guests today have been Serge Onan who's an artist and editor of various drawing publications, including Drawings on Writing, and João Ribas, critic and curator at large of the...
I like that, though. And large.
Just large curator. Drawing Center. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.